Welcome to our Bible study on the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11, verses 16 through 19, and then jumping to verse 25 through 30, a passage that I am sure you've heard before. Like always, I am assuming that you have read the passage, that you have your Bible with you, and that you remember our translations may be different from one another. Clearly, the heart of our reading today is in verses 25 through 30, a powerful announcement of divine revelation and an offer of grace given to us by Jesus. But before that happens, Jesus speaks of rejection and unbelief. In the first part of our passage, verses 16 through 19, Jesus rebukes those who reject both John the Baptist and himself. In verses 20 through 24, which are not a part of our reading, but they also help set the context, Jesus reproaches the cities in which he has ministered and which still refused to receive him. As we look at verses 16 through 19, it can be seen as a parable. The children playing in the marketplace want to play a happy game, that is, a wedding. And a flute and dancing are appropriate. But the other group will not play. So the first group tries to get them to play funeral, in which wailing and mourning are appropriate. But they reject that too. According to some interpreters familiar with Near Eastern customs, they have suggested that the parable of the children also reflects gender roles. The round dance that occurred at weddings, accompanied by flutes, was performed by men, while mourning, often done by professionals, was women's work. This wedding funeral imagery depicts the differences in style between Jesus and John the Baptist. John is too forbidding, and Jesus is too happy. Jesus came eating, drinking, and mixing with sinners, and they said in verse 19, "Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." Now, the background for this phrase is in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 20 through 21, which prescribes how parents should deal with a rebellious son. And quote, "And they shall tell the elders of the city, 'This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard.' All the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from the midst of you, and all Israel shall hear and fear." It's a pretty heavy label, this label of glutton and a drunkard. So it's far more serious than it first appears. If Jesus is, in fact, a glutton and a drunkard by the standards of Deuteronomy chapter 21, God's law prescribes that he shall die a violent and dishonorable death. This verse gives us a veiled hint of the cross that awaits Jesus. John the Baptist, on the other hand, you may recall, lived an ascetic life in the desert, dressed in a leather girdle, ate locust and wild honey. Few people would want to live like John, but his hell, fire, and brimstone preaching drew great crowds. He was arrested and later beheaded because he gave offense to Herod's family, but apparently he offended others as well, which is why in verse 18 they say, "He has a demon." While John looks like a religious fanatic, Jesus appears to be a libertine. He is not as fastidious as some regarding his diet. He heals on the Sabbath. His disciples are not scrupulous in their observance of the law, and he defends them. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 8, chapter 15, verses 1 through 20. Even worse is Jesus' association with, and apparent approval of, tax collectors and sinners. The root problem for those who reject Jesus, of course, is their awareness that taking John and or Jesus seriously requires that they change their lives. Both John and Jesus jolt us and push us into uncomfortable places. John demands that we repent and move in new directions, give up cherished pleasures, and take on uncomfortable responsibilities. Jesus turns comfortable assumptions on their heads. If we look at his Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, verses 1 through 48, we can ask, how can the poor be in spirit be blessed, or those who mourn, or the meek? How can Jesus make such outrageous demands regarding anger, or adultery, or divorce, or oaths, or retaliation, or the treatment of enemies? But if we can find fault with John and Jesus, see, then we can ignore their demands, and it is far easier to criticize than to obey. And so this generation finds fault with both of these very different but very compelling men. And by the way, Jesus uses the phrase, this generation, several times in Matthew, always in a negative way, or in the context of judgment. Chapter 12, verse 41 through 42, chapter 23, verse 36, chapter 24, verse 34, and it is obviously referring to his generation, but the lessons apply to us as well. As you're looking at verse 19, you see, but wisdom is justified by her children. The meaning of this proverb is much the same as, by their fruits you will know them, which we see in chapter 7, verse 16 and verse 20. Jesus challenges his critics to look at the effects of his ministry. In chapter 11, verse 5, just go up the page a little bit. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. To fail to understand the significance of these events, one must be blind and deaf, must refuse to see and stop up one's ears. Now we come into the funner part, verses 25 through 27. At that time, connects Jesus' comments about the cities of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum that we did not read, but it connects it with the prayer that follows. The focus changes from those who have rejected Jesus to those who have accepted Jesus. God has hidden the truth from the wise and understanding at verse 25, but has revealed the truth to infants. The mood also changes. In verses 16 through 19, Jesus expresses frustration, tinged with anger toward this generation. But in verses 25 through 27, his mood is optimistic and thankful. Jesus' optimism is based not on any recent success, but rather on God's gracious authority and the intimacy between Father and Son. In verses 25 and 26, that you hid these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to infants, reflects Jesus' personal experience. Those in high office reject Jesus, but common people, including subcommon tax collectors and sinners, flock to him. The polarity between those who reject Jesus and those who flock to him is self-perpetuating. The more that Jesus appeals to the rejected of society, the more that society, the high society people, reject Jesus. Not being full of self, the little ones are open to receiving God. Having no religious assurance, they are open to receiving grace. Possessing no wisdom, they are open to learning from Jesus. Paul amplifies these thoughts in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18 and verse 25, when he speaks of the cross as foolishness to those who are dying, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. He tells us, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. There are some exceptions to this rule, and exceptions also that prove the rule. Nicodemus is a Pharisee, and he came to Jesus by night in John chapter 3. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man, and he provided a burial place for Jesus and attended to his body after the crucifixion in chapter 27, verses 57 through 60. Gamaliel, a Pharisee, counseled the Sanhedrin to be careful in their judgment of the disciples, lest they find themselves in conflict with God's will. And that's in Acts 5. And of course, we know of Saul of Tarsus, a Pharisee who became a great Christian missionary and an author of much of the New Testament. These exceptions demonstrate that the gospel can be good news even for the rich and powerful, but it is far more difficult for people with great personal resources, whether it's wealth or genius, to admit their need for Christ. Christ blesses the humble, and sometimes it can be difficult for the rich and powerful to be humble. Notice how verse 27, the language seems to be more in keeping with Jesus' prayer in the Gospel of John, chapter 17, than with the rest of Matthew's Gospel. We come now to some of the most beloved and quoted verses of the Bible, because all of us feel burdened and in need of rest. Verses 28 through 30, come to me, all you who labor and are heavily burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. In their original context, these verses spoke specifically to those burdened by the Jewish law. God gave the law to guide the Jewish people through the moral thickets of life. But well-intentioned people, possibly well-intentioned people, embellished the law until it became its own thicket. Religious professionals prided themselves on their observance of the law, but even they could not avoid infractions. The common person did not stand a chance of perfectly observing the law. Verse 29, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. The rabbis often likened the law to a yoke. A yoke was a wooden bar or frame that fitted across the necks of two oxen to make them a team. A yoke imposed a measure of control on the animals. Neither animal was free to go its own direction because its bond to the other animal served as a constraint. Animals with a yoke are under the control of the master. So part of the point is that we cannot choose to serve no master at all, but we can choose only which master we will serve. The yoke of the law is better than the yoke of the world, because the yoke of the law is God-inspired. But in the hands of the scribes and Pharisees, the yoke of the law became almost as burdensome as the yoke of the world. Jesus is not proposing that we go yokeless, but that we accept his yoke, which is Christos. There you go, a nice Greek word. Christos, not with an I, but with an E. It means manageable, mild, or pleasant, as opposed to something that is harsh, or hard, or sharp. A well-made yoke distributes the load evenly, making the task easier. A well-fitted yoke follows the contours of the oxen's neck, so that it does not rub or chaff. A legend says that Jesus, assisting his carpenter father, made the best yokes available, yokes that would serve both master and oxen well. A yoke usually joins two oxen together to work as a team. When Jesus invites us to take his yoke and to learn from him, he is inviting us to join him in harness, to allow him to take the lead, to let him help us through difficult places, to give him the opportunity to show us how it is done. At verse 29, I am gentle. The Greek word is praus, P-R-A-U-S. It means meek or humble, and lowly, tapienos, again means humble and lowly in heart. We read in Numbers 12:3 that Moses was humble, and Jesus blessed the meek, promising that they shall inherit the earth in chapter 5, verse 5, a promise that seems counterintuitive. It appears to us that the bold and forceful inherit the earth. Perhaps the meek will inherit heaven, but we doubt that they're going to inherit the earth. Jesus' promise, however, is based on God's economy rather than the ways of the world. Just as Jesus transformed the world by his meek submission to God's will, so also, by God's grace, the meek, those who submit their will to God, will find themselves possessed of power that transcends their natural skill and ability. Verse 29, and you will find rest. The Greek word is anapazin. It can mean respite for your souls. Jeremiah called Israel to ask for the ancient paths where the good way lies, promising that if they would do so, they would find rest for your souls. Israel, however, rejected Jeremiah's counsel, saying, we will not walk in it. And you can find that in Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 16. Now Jesus is making a similar promise to those who take his yoke upon them. Anapazin denotes a temporary rest, a respite, for example, of a soldier on R&R, to refresh us for the work that lies ahead. Jesus does not invite us to the layabout rest of an easy chair, but to the discipleship rest of a purposeful life. He does not promise clock watchers an early quitting time, but instead offers disciples energy, vision, and purpose. While the original context referred to the burden of the Jewish law, there is nothing in these words to suggest that they should not also extend to our weariness and burdens today. We are weary today and burdened by many things, from COVID-19 and concerns about health and reopening, to concerns about relationships, finances, and a thousand other things. We come to verse 30, and Jesus says that his yoke is easy and his burden is light, not because God's law is abolished, but because Jesus shares knowledge. Hear that phrase, learn from me. This yoke is Jesus's because Jesus also wears it. Believers are called to join him and walk with him, not just to be loaded down with a new law while he watches. Jesus offers every generation new ways to understand, to think, and to act as believers who share the yoke with him. Thank you for listening. Take care and God bless.